Yes, you can, in the March baby.
What, whatever you want.
Did you want to ask something right here, talking about all of you and enjoy all of you?
You're gonna buy it.
Something you might go outside or done something strange, you say, but you have to understand.
See, that keeps you.
He's the worst thing you could possibly be, a Pisces male.
Rats.
No. I think I should tell you. I'm not saying. Really, good.
I mean. Yeah.
Don't worry about anything, it's all that microphone is digital.
They told me I was a diabetic, so he knew all this. And I took that for a walk.
No, that was to make the water drink.
Yeah, if you want.
Into the garbage.
I know some of the things that I don't think that's ignoring it.
Well.
If I ever get a little spirit for you, you know.
I think what I want to say is. I wanna be wrong. The Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy, without professing attachment to any Theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great families of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it to time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among Theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among Theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as Theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true Theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. Here in Philadelphia, we have 2 weekly meetings and 1 monthly meeting. Our weekly meetings are on Wednesday and Sunday. On Wednesday, we also have a reference library. So the doors are open at 5:30 on Wednesday, and the library is open until 7:30. And our Wednesday study class begins at 7:45 and lasts until 9 p.m. There's always reference material for the class that night when the library hours are open, and there's always a student there to help you. And you can always prepare in advance for Wednesday's study class. This Wednesday we'll be studying in the Ocean of Theosophy Chapter 12 on the after-death states in detail, the natural separation of the principles. On Sunday we have a meeting here every week, and the doors open at 10:30 and the meeting starts at 11 and lasts until 12 noon. It's always a more formal presentation of particular aspect of the philosophy and before and after each meeting on Wednesday and Sunday, the book table is open. If you'd like to buy any straight line theosophical literature or devotional pamphlets, everything is sold at cost. There's no profit at that table. The monthly meeting we have is on the third Friday of each month, and it coincides with the theosophical duty to be involved in the comparative study in religion. And the next one we have is March 19th, and the general heading for these sections of study are reincarnation, myth, and symbol, and this particular will be on Psyche and Proteus. We are having a special inner lodge symposium consisting of voluntary contributions from the students of Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, and New York City. It is in Philadelphia, and it is dated April 17th, 2010. It will last from 11 a.m. to 4 p.m., and there will be more information at the book table there also. Everything that happens here is done on voluntary contributions of time, service, and money. All are welcome, and all are appreciated. And everything that was shared, as well as extra words of greatness from the founders, are included in this pamphlet that's available the foyer in the table beginning where the usher is. Today we're having a presentation talk or lecture on the healing power of mind, and we'll begin with a reading from the Voice of the Silence. Saith the pupil, O teacher, what shall I do to reach to wisdom? O wise one, what to gain perfection? Search for the paths, but O Lanu, be of clean heart before thou startest on thy journey. Before thou takest thy first step, learn to discern the real from the false, the ever-fleeting from the everlasting. Learn above all to separate head learning from soul wisdom, the eye from the heart doctrine. Yea, ignorance is like unto a closed and airless vessel, the soul a bird shut up within. It warbles not, nor can it stir a feather. But the songster mute and torpid sits and of exhaustion dies. But even ignorance is better than head learning with no soul wisdom to illuminate and guide it. The seeds of wisdom cannot sprout and grow in airless space. To live and reap experience, the mind needs breadth and depth and points to draw it towards the diamond soul. Seek not those points in Maya's realm, but soar beyond illusions. Search the eternal and the changeless Sat, mistrusting fancy's false suggestions. For mind is like a mirror. It gathers dust while it reflects. It needs the gentle breezes of soul wisdom to brush away the dust of our illusions. Seek, O beginner, to blend thy mind and soul. Shun ignorance and likewise shun illusion. Avert thy face from world deceptions. Mistrust thy senses, they are false. But within thy body, the shrine of thy sensations, seek in the impersonal for the eternal man, and have him, and having sought him out, look inward. Thou art Buddha.
No greater mystery stands before us than mind. And our title today is The Healing Power of Mind. But within that title, there's much that is left out, for there is that opposite. So therefore, what is the power that dwells or embraces the mind? Well, it's said in this philosophy that we are mind beings. Well, we live in the mind, but we are souls that use the mind. And it says, blend the soul and the mind and make it one. Well, we need to talk about mind and what it is. We all have one. And we all use one. Our thought, our will, our feelings, our imagination, and our memory are all attributes of the mind, are all vehicles for the mind. Instinct, intellect, intuition, they're all modes of consciousness, but they radiate from the mind, or they're an aspect of that mind. Personal, impersonal, attitude that is taken up by the mind. What do all these have to do with a healing power or with power at all? Well, look at us. Look at us here today. What leads us around? Why do we go here? Why do we go there? Why do we do this? Why do we do that? Many do not even think about it. They are driven simply by their feelings, by their desires, by their wants, by their needs. This is what we find in the world in which we live in. But the ancients said that man is much greater than this. We see his powers, for we have manipulated and altered the physical world in which we live. But we ask, for the betterment of humanity? And often the answer is no. Sometimes it is. So what is it that we are missing? What is it that we don't get? Well, if we go back to the first statement, we are mind beings, or we live in the mind. What does that do for us? Well, that eliminates one aspect of us, the body. If we live in the mind, do we live in the body? Well, many do. And they think that is who they are. They're this physical structure, this vehicle that has feelings, can see, can touch, can hear, all these phenomenal powers. But these powers go where? Lead to what? Well, they're directed by something. It's that bridge between spirit and matter, and it's the mind. The mind is where everything is directed, and from there, everything proceeds. So we have a stimulus, visual one, hearing, and it goes to the mind, and the mind registers that as an idea. And that idea, therefore, is put into motion. A thought, a word, a deed. Nothing begins with a deed, then a thought, then an idea. It's always an idea. And the idea usually comes from the stimulus of our environment. What? We live in the age of anxiety. That's our environment, because everyone is taken up by the environment. And it's our attitude toward the environment that creates the anxiety. But if we can change our attitude about the environment and see its purpose and our position in it and who we are in it, it changes, because we know that the environment or the anxiety is outside of us, or what created the anxiety is outside of us. The anxiety is in us. So we see a cause and effect. But what's really causing it? What we see outside of us? That's what we blame it on. That's the cause of my anxiety. No, It's the idea that we hold about the world in which we live and our relationship to it. And those ideas are held in the mind and by the ideas that we think are true. That is reality. So what is our reality? Well, if we have all these senses and all these powers and they are leading us around and they make us eat, they make us sleep, they make us do most of the activities of our waking life, can we change that? Can we become the director or that which is in charge of our feelings and our emotions and what we see and what we hear? Because the environment is outside of us and it's within us that we react. There's where the anxiety lies. So what is it that we are lacking? Well, we're lacking the understanding of this power we have. And this power dwells within the mind. And by the use of the mind, we become the gods that we are. Wait a second. Gods? Us? Look at this world we've created. Yes, we've created it because we are touched by the environment. We think that is what it is. And we only live but once, and it's... we've been cursed. It's the ultimate sin we've committed, and now we're paying the price. Flapdoodle. Hogwash. That is a lie. That is not reality. But that is a reality that we've come to accept. We are the creators of our world. We are the creators of the society in which we live. We have created everything. And we think, oh, that's not possible. Well, we haven't lived once. We've lived many times. And we don't come into circumstances and situations by some chance. We've had a hand in creating this. But now we also have a hand in making it right. And helping not only ourselves, but all of humanity. Because humanity does not understand the relationship between the mind and the body. They're only beginning, science is understanding what the mind can do. Scientists are doing studies. We only heard recently on the news that women who are abused and held in a marriage that is unloving and controlling, they die at a much younger age than their spouse. And this is because of the mind is being locked in. Well, the ancients have a remedy. There's a remedy for this. And it is, you don't have to go there or go there to find the remedy. You just have to sit where you are. And look within, thou art Buddha. Well, what do we look at? Well, we look at the changing panorama of thoughts and ideas and feelings and perceptions that dwell within us. We sit and be quiet for one moment and we are hit with a flash of ideas and remembrances and all kinds of things that distract us. Because when we sit and be quiet, what are we looking for? What are we trying to concentrate on? Well, what we are doing is training the mind to listen to what the soul wants. But how do we know what the soul wants? Well, the soul wants what every human being wants. It is no different in any of us. It is that illuminating aspect, that love that we feel for other human beings, that compassion that springs up when we see the suffering of other parts of the world. It is that which dwells within us that is the union of the mind and the soul. It's the heart. How do we unlock that? Well, there's an exercise that we are asked to practice when we come in these rooms, especially when we speak to our brothers and our sisters, our friends or our foe. There's two ways you can talk to someone, or there's two ways you can see something, personally or impersonally. The analogy is used, we are like a traveler in a foreign land. We come, if you've traveled, you go to a foreign country. What are you then? You're the observer. You're watching, you're looking, you're seeing what's different, what's unusual, what's pleasant, what's unusual, but you're looking, but you're standing apart from it. You're the observer from another land. The only problem is, we've forgotten what land we're from. We're soul beings. We are eternal. We are eternal. So that these fleeting moments of this personal idea bind us to this personal world. And in that is the reason we come back again and again and again. Because the body, the mind are attached to the personal idea. But once we begin to look at the impersonal, well, I got the personal down, I know what that is. But the impersonal, well, I guess I can find that. If I know what the personal is, I can find the impersonal. Not really. Because the impersonal is beyond that which is personal. From the impersonal comes that personal idea. To be impersonal, one looks at something as the observer, as the perceiver. In fact, that's how we are to look at our daily life. We are to be the observer and not the reactionary critic that we've become. To observe life. And then make a conscious choice on how to deal with that. Not be impulsively pulled here or pulled there and controlled by those feelings and desires, but become the controller of them. And the only way we can do that is impersonally. Because if I treat you differently than this person, then that's not being impersonal. Sure. Our love for someone is personal. But can we transmute that love into love for everyone? Can we transmute that love that we have for one being to a family, to children, to our extended family, to our community, and ultimately to the world in which we live? Can we stand there? Can we stand in that position as the perceiver, untouched by all that comes to pass, and be the observer of that, and see the impersonal? That is the healing power of mind. If we can take that position and stand as the impersonal observer, and greet life that way, we are not elated or cast down, but we have found that middle path that Buddha talked about, that all great sages have pointed out the way. There is a great yoga that the students of theosophy try to practice. It's called Raja Yoga, Gupta Vidya. It's the control of the mind. You don't need a teacher. You don't need a guru. You don't need to go here or go there. You can do that every waking moment of your life. Be the observer. And know that through concentration, one can achieve this letting go of these physical senses. Not letting go in the sense that you're not going to feel, you're not going to see anymore, is that they're not going to affect us in that way. They are just a means for us to come in contact with this physical plane. But we are not this physical plane. We are not these bodies. In fact, we are not these minds. We are much more than that. And that is what we need to know and to understand. That our greatness lies not in that personal aspect that we have pandered to. It is not what we have that makes us great. It's what is within us that makes us great. Makes everyone great. And the eyes are the windows to that soul. We just have to clear up the vision of what it is that we are. Now, there's a discipline that we can perform. We can guard our speech. We can watch what we say. We can be ever vigilant of the sounds that we produce. We can clean our minds. And we can free it from the bondage that we've placed it under by what we see, by what we do, and by what we value. Because we live in a world where the sensory input has become greater and greater and greater. And we see those souls lost around us that are being led through these psychic impulses in every direction. Violence, lust, insatiable. And we will not satiate our desires by acting on them. We have to restrain the senses. Restrain them. And we have to make our body a better vehicle to serve all. Not only serve ourselves and get what we want, but to serve each other. To do those things which will help, which will make us strong, which will make us an aid or a helping hand to those around us. But Plato had it right. Ideas do rule the world. And we know well how true this is. For we live in a time when ideas are degraded, and so is humanity. But there is that elevating idea that we are an aspect, a drop of that great ocean, a ray of that great sun. That which is boundless, eternal, omnipresent, and eternal, boundless, immutable, and omnipresent is what we are in our true essence. Truly, we are that which is, was, and always will be. This life is but a fleeting manifestation of opportunities and of things of the past. But if we live in the moment, we create the future. If we live in the past, we bring forward the past. And if we live in the future, we're not living anywhere. We are not here. So we are asked to be ever vigilant, for in this moment, we decide our future. But even more, we may decide the future of humanity by what we do not do. We are to help. And our minds have the power of healing not only ourselves, but the world. How? Through the ideas that we hold to be true. The reality that is the inheritance of all humanity. That we are truly divine in our true nature. We never die. We never die. And reincarnation and karma are a process by which we come back again and again to put back into harmony that which we have placed out of harmony. And our mind is the big factor. But without the mind, we would not have been able to lift up all of nature. So we need to make our mind clean and clear to the truths and the realities of what we are. Any questions? Well, one thought. Just to show us, the mind needs to be challenged. And theosophy knows this. The ancients knew this. And it needs to think about things in ways in which our rational mind does not like to. Here are some paradoxes that we need to dwell upon. And these are found in the Light on the Path. There's 9 of them. Kill out ambition, but work as those who are ambitious. Kill out desire of life, but respect life as those do who desire it. Kill out desire of comfort, but be happy as those are who live for happiness. Kill out all sense of separateness, but stand alone and isolated. Kill out desire for sensation, but learn from sensation and observe it. Kill out the hunger for growth, but grow as the flower grows, unconsciously, but eagerly anxious to open its soul to the air. Desire power ardently, but that power which the disciple shall covet is that which shall make him appear as nothing in the eyes of men. Desire peace fervently, but the peace you shall desire is that sacred peace which nothing can disturb. And lastly, desire possessions above all. But those possessions must belong to the pure soul only, and be possessed therefore by all pure souls equally, and thus be the special property of the whole only when united. The powers of the mind to heal.
One of the points made in the talk was that the mind forms ideas from impressions it receives from the environment through the senses. But is that the only way we get ideas? Suppose we were incapacitated that way, or we lived in a cave somewhere, there were no books, no teachers. Would we have no ideas? Where would they come from?
Would we have no ideas if we did not have the stimulus from our outside environment? Well, theosophy talks about inherent ideas. Ideas that well up within us because we are human beings. We are sentient beings. That within us dwells or radiates this compassion, this love, this want for unity. We have this yearning to ever move forward or to move closer to spirit. Because look at us. Why did we come here? Because we're yearning for something. Something within our own nature that we are missing. We're looking for that peace. But it's peace of the spirit, of the soul. And these ideas spring up almost spontaneously within us. Sure, we need to nurture them and urge them forth. But oftentimes, we would never have found these rooms if we did not know that the truth can be found somewhere. Because we all have looked. We've looked every nook and cranny that we could find. We followed anybody who said they had the truth. Any group, anybody. You have the truth. I want to hear it. We've all said this to ourselves. And we've all come away unsatisfied. Because within us we know that the truth that I hear has to be true for everyone. Not just for this group or that group. It has to be true for everyone, or it's not the truth. And this is why we have found theosophy. For within us, we've been searching. And the power of the mind, you look, and you dwell upon something, and it does appear. And the opportunity is presented, but it is only an opportunity. It is up to us to grab that opportunity and take advantage of it for the betterment of ourselves, but of others as well.
First of all, I apologize for my English. I understood you say that we are not just a body, this mind. And then, what would you say, what more we are?
What, if we're not the bodies and the minds, then what are we? What more are we? Well, that's something that we really have to answer for ourselves. But what we can offer is that we know that we are not that which is ever changing. It's whatever changes, we are not that, because who's witnessing this change? Well, it's something that's unchanging, that's constant, and it is ever the witness to the changing panorama of life. So we know we're not the body because it's changing. We can almost, we have reminiscences or recollections of an early childhood and getting older, and all these scenes of life pass before us and constantly changing. But within that panorama of seeing, there's the witness of all these changes. Well, the same holds true for our feelings and our emotions. Nothing changes more. And we're very thankful that we're not these emotions, because we would be like the raging elephant, wild in the forest, taking shadows for trees and being going mad. But there's within us that which is unchanging, the observer. That when you go to a foreign country and you take in the whole spectrum of what you see, you become the observer because it's foreign to you. Well, that's what we are inside. In our deepest, innermost chamber, there is that perceiver, that knower, that is a witness to the changing panorama of life, to that changing aspect. So once we recognize that there is something that's unchanging about us, we need to find that unchanging aspect. We need to look for it. And this is where many of the meditation, many of the books and pamphlets that we offer help us to discover that eternal pilgrim. And that can be discovered through effort and concentration upon that which is higher. Now we are told that our mind is so bogged down in the material, personal world that we have to make it or have to show it that it can go beyond this and it can be can expand its depth and breadth to grasp that diamond soul. And to do that, it needs to deal with and consider the abstract. We don't like doing that because it takes us out of our comfort zone. But the mind needs to consider that which is abstract to it. And one of the practices is space and our position in space and our relationship to space and our expansive nature in terms of space. And these ideas of compassion and love, all these ideas have an abstract part of their nature, and we are to consider that and expand the mind and beyond this physical realm of particulars.
And do you believe that the concentration and the meditation are the only tools to clear the mind?
Are concentration and meditation the only tools? No, but those are the tools in which will bring us the greatest results. Because through concentration and meditation, we can let go of the personal idea. And there's no other way that we can do that, because if we are bound by the personal, we need to take a position where we're impersonal. And how can we do that? Well, we do that in meditation. We do that through concentration.
We heard once that concentration and meditation is the only safe way to clear the mind. It seems like there would be other ways that would not be advisable.
Well, there are other ways of clearing the mind, but
purifying
the mind. There are other yogas that can be practiced, union with God, union with the Supreme. But we are told over and over again that Raja Yoga is the safest for us to practice.
The Raja Yoga is the meditation.
Pardon?
The Raja Yoga.
Raja.
Raja Yoga is the meditation.
Well, Raja Yoga is the control of the mind. You know,
meditation.
Well, we can be meditating right now by looking, by being the observer of the what is going on. Always the observer and reacting from that place. Because when we react from the personal, we become impulsive. But when we react or we act from that which is impersonal, we see things more clearly because we have cut that tie of that personal self, because the personal self colors everything that we do because we have a vested interest in the outcome of what we are doing.
Pure Raja Yoga and the ideal meditation and concentration may be beyond where we are today as thinkers. So aren't there powers of mind like reasoning from premise to conclusion or drawing analogies or correspondences or just trying to be aware and think critically from the basis of eternal principles? Aren't those the beginnings of working toward this very lofty one-pointedness and meditation 24/7?
Yes, spiritual knowledge will free us. Well, what is this spiritual knowledge? Well, it is universal ideas. So when we go from premise to conclusion, what is the idea that is based upon? A universal principle? Well, we find in philosophy, Plato and, name escapes me, his student,
Aristotle.
That we hear we have two philosophers, one using universals and one using particulars. So our scientific world has adopted the Aristotelian way of thinking, from premise to conclusion. Well, we see that many things that are thought to be true are not, because the premise is not correct. There is no universal basis for this idea. Now, Plato took the universal idea, but brought it into a particular and tried to take it back to that universal idea. And if it wouldn't go, there was something wrong with the very premise itself. So there's a scientific method that is adopted. And spiritual knowledge gives us a glimpse into our true nature through analogy and correspondence, through paradoxes. We grapple with ideas that are beyond our ken, our understanding, but only because we haven't dug for the gold that lies within these ideas. And there are gems within them. But if we don't dig, we don't get dirty, we're not going to find them. And that's why this philosophy is for only those who want it. You have to want it. Because behind will stands desire. And we have to elevate that desire into that spiritual realm. And we will find the answers that we are looking for.
Well, so far, everything's well and good in terms of using the powers of mind to find that wisdom. But the same devotional books tell us that true knowledge is of loving deeds of the child. That doesn't seem to have anything to do with intellect or reason. What role does loving deeds have?
Loving deeds of kindness. Well, if we read the Bhagavad Gita, the mind is not talked about per se in any definitive way, or the will. But what we see is that because we are these sentient beings, we are these human beings, that we are compelled to act. Action is part of our nature. So we are to reach this place of spirituality or oneness with all of life. We are not to look for the results of our actions. We are to be single-minded, single-pointed in our pursuit. But what does it mean to be single-minded? Well, that means to be concentrated. Concentrated on one idea. Concentrated on one task, and not looking for the results of those actions, not looking for praise, not looking for anything, but doing our duty, that which is before us. And that is done through a single-mindedness, or we can call it concentration. But the mind is involved, but it's involved in a way that we are controlling it. Not that it's controlling us. So that when action is performed, the mind isn't off somewhere else, doing something else, basking in the glory of what it is doing. But it is doing what it is doing. It is concentrating on the act itself and giving up the results to that great law.
But it says in the voice that three halls await the weary pilgrim: the ignorance.
Where we are now.
The hall of learning. Well, we're trying. We're trying to get into the hall of learning at least. At least we've gotten a seat there, we hope. And the hall of wisdom. So we need, even though the philosophy says we have been impressed with these ideas as infant humanity, and these are innate in us, we're trying to draw them out. We need that hall of learning to relearn, really. It's maybe it should be called the hall of relearning. But the wisdom comes through the loving deeds, the true knowledge, where it really becomes a part of us again. That wisdom comes through the loving deeds. Because there's been great examples like Jaka Verma, who was considered an ignorant man in many respects. But he wasn't. He was that soul wisdom shone forth in him brilliantly.
Well, the hall of learning, or the hall of ignorance, is that hall of darkness where we live and die. But then the light somehow shines within us. And we move into that hall of learning, where we learn that we are not these bodies. We are not these circumstances. We are more than that. And we become aware of these spiritual realities. And we live our life in accordance with them. And hopefully, we will become wise in the pursuit of that. But that is not our purpose. Of loving deeds is our purpose. Because our mind can take us anywhere. And if it's that intellectual mind that is totally rational, it becomes cold and hard. And it separates us from the world. You know, instinct is a divine quality. It's a divine quality that dwells in the animal kingdom, plant kingdom, the mineral kingdom. That is a pure consciousness. But in us, it dwells as well, but it's not pure anymore because it has been distorted by a rational mind. But our only hope, and we are told, if we begin to read the secret doctrine, its purpose is to reawaken in us that intuitive power of understanding. Paradoxes, analogy, a correspondence will awaken that intuitive nature. And we will know what is true. We will feel what is true. But it is like that nugget of gold. We must want it and we must dig for it.
Well, it's sad to me today that the Sunday newspapers are not like what they used to be.
Well, are they on Saturdays now?
Especially the funny papers. We call them Popeye the Sailor Man. And it was the loving deeds of our parents. And we waited anxiously for them to take the time so that we could sit around them and listen to them perform a loving deed from their heart when they read the funny papers. And the very popular one was Popeye the Sailor Man. I am what I am. Now, it's strange that I should remember that and also remember the parent that impressed upon us the philosophy in those terms, even though we didn't understand it. So wouldn't you say the loving deed would be coming from the heart, not understanding necessarily what I am, what I am? We know what that means now.
We know that it comes from the heart. But the blending of the mind and the soul dwells within the heart. That is where the true soul is. And it is rather, we would imagine that all of us have stories like were just told to us, about loving deeds of a parent that did it out of pure love because they wanted us to enjoy or to expand our awareness and make us more human.
The Raja Yoga that we're speaking of here, the understanding of the mind and the idea of being detached and being impersonal, that would be called a skill to learn. And like any other skill that we have in school, arithmetic or whatever, we had teachers. Is that the reason why it is beneficial for us to study the great masters like Jesus and Buddha, Krishna, and so on, so that their words will enable us to see the possibilities and also the paths that we could resonate and choose from to set ourselves in that direction?
Well, we are very fortunate. We have the aid of many great teachers in these rooms. If we go to the book table, we will find countless aids to remind us of that impersonal way of approaching life. The voice of the silence, light on the path. The Bhagavad Gita is no better a teacher. But we have the ocean of theosophy. We have the secret doctrine. We have Isis unveiled. They're all presented in an impersonal way that it arouses within us our intuition of the true nature of ourselves. And it is through this impersonal act or this impersonal point of view or attitude that we develop that we become free. We heal ourselves, but we heal those around us. Because we all know what the personal idea has done. You know, we've seen emperors and rulers walk over dead bodies to get to their throne. You know, we see it everywhere, what that personal idea does. It separates and divides. We need to develop within ourselves an impersonal attitude. And it's not something that will happen overnight. It's something that we need to work on and be ever vigilant. For life is not stagnant. It seems that whatever we need will come to us. And maybe that lesson we need of that impersonal idea and personal idea, impersonal and personal, is something which we are confronted with daily. And we have a choice of how to deal with it or how to let ourselves deal with it, or we restrain ourselves and we decide how we're going to deal with it.
When we take the position of the observer, is it a different observer in each of us, or is it the same observer?
Is it a different observer in each of us? Well, yes and no. It's different in the fact that it dwells within you. But it's the same because it dwells within all of us. We see it manifest through a individuality that we are. But this individuality is impersonal. We call it us, but it is the same in all. That's what makes universal brotherhood a fact in nature. Because we are all of the same essence. That knower is the same in all of us. That individuality is the same in all of us, only colored by the personality that we think we are.
Is the objective to eliminate personality, to allow the higher, more pure, true self to manifest through and purify the mind?
Is the object to kill the personality? We think not. that it is a tool for us to gather experience and knowledge. The only problem that the personality provides or gives to us are hindrances. We think that we are separate. And as long as the personality does that, it becomes an obstacle. But we can take that impersonal idea and incorporate it into the personality. We can do it in our work. We can do it in our relationships. We can do it wherever we go. We have that ability. But again, there's no one true and fast rule for doing it. We all need to experiment with that. We all need to, through trial, to find the path that we are going to tread. Because all of us, we're all different. Our personalities are all different. But the one thing that is the same is that individuality, that impersonal aspect, that knower and that perceiver. We think it's different because it's in us. It's mine, but it's all of ours. So that when we act from this universal point of view, we include everyone. No one is excluded. Well, we hope you found these ideas helpful, and we encourage you to further your exploration in these ideas. And we would also like to remind you that all activities at this lodge are done on a voluntary basis of time, service, and money, and all are welcome to participate. Meeting adjourned.
Thank you.
You did a good job. Thank you.